The following program, entitled Race Issues or Peace Issues, was recorded on Saturday, April 27th, at All Souls UU Church in Kansas City. The event was sponsored by PeaceWorks KC and moderated by Lucky Garcia. We'll let Lucky introduce the panel.
So, first off, we have Diane Burkholder. she, her pronouns. And is a Black mixed race feminist community organizer who has lived in Kansas City since 2011 via South Dakota and California. Her education is in sociology at CSU Long Beach and ethnic studies from San Francisco State University. She's the co-founder of One Struggle KC, a coalition of Kansas City activists seeking to connect the struggles of oppressed Black communities locally and globally. Diane is the founder and lead consultant for the DB Approach, providing anti-oppression and social justice coaching and training. Locally, she co-moderates the Kansas City Freethinkers of Color for non-religious people of color, Kansas City's Mixed Roots for mixed race individuals and families, and Brown Voices, Brown Pulse for LGBTQ people of color. Diane also serves as the chair of the American Humanist Association's LGBTQ Alliance. To Diane's left, we have Summer. Summer is a community organizer with the Palestine advocacy group, Al Hadef, here in Kansas City. Born into a family of Palestinian refugees, Summer is most concerned about the ongoing violence of marginalized communities around the world. She is an experienced organizer, having led educational campaigns and public outreach. Summer ensures that solidarity and coalition building remain at the heart of her Palestine activism. Summer. To Summer's left, Diana Martinez. Diana has been an organizer and activist for the last 8 years. She began her activism in 2010 by joining the DREAM Act movement, and has since been involved in countless demonstrations and direct actions. Diana has been a leader in the Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance since then. She has also worked for the Fight for 15 for the last 5 years, the Movement for Economic Justice and Union Rights. Diana is currently a community organizer for advocates for immigrant rights and reconciliation. Last but not least, we have John Trammell. John has over 20 years of social work experience in the areas of community organizing, community development, mental health, domestic violence, and social justice education, organizing, and activism. He has spent the last 7 years focused on creating and sustaining social justice support for families in the education and child welfare arenas. John is a founding member of Showing Up for Racial Justice, Kansas City. He is committed to racial justice work because he believes that white people have a responsibility to deconstruct the ways the system of white supremacy has influenced all of us and start taking action to address it in ourselves and our communities. John Trump. What a great panel. Very exciting. So if you guys will just kind of one by one, tell us how your group started, what was the need, and describe some of the work that you do.
So AIR has actually been around since about 2012, but it hasn't been, they were focusing on ally education. It hasn't been until about a year and a half since I came on that we started doing deportation defense work. And clearly the need has always been there, but unfortunately, there hasn't, AIR didn't have a full-time organizer. I came on as a full-time organizer to be able to get this going, get the network going for deportation defense. And we really work on three areas. We do prevention, which is know your rights for the immigrant community, also ally education to try to bring understanding and try to demystify some of the immigration myths that are out there. We also are working on an intervention network, which will be a rapid response, hopefully to go and be witnesses to ICE raids and really hold that agency accountable because it's a rogue Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, which is the agency that enforces immigration laws. They're a rogue agency that doesn't really have any oversight. So it's up to the community to go and push back on all the fearful tactics that they're going and implementing in the immigrant community. And then the other side of it is detention and post-detention support. So we help families kind of navigate the deportation process and help plug them into different resources, because it's usually the sole provider that is detained. So then the family is left without financial resources, and we try to plug them in and help them however we can.
So Showing Up for Racial Justice Kansas City has been in existence for a little over 3 years. In the aftermath of Michael Brown's murder by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, there was a lot of organizing that began to really ramp up in the Kansas City area, a lot led by One Struggle Kansas City and other organizing groups led by people of color. And during that time, white folks were coming to those events and coming to those actions and meetings and began to show up to those spaces in a way that wasn't always helpful, and also was taking up a lot of space and a lot of energy from the people of color leading to really try to deal with and take care of the white people in that space, so much so that it was distracting and disrupting the movement and the work that was being done. And the request was made and the agitation was given to white folks to say, hey, white people need to take some responsibility for educating each other and themselves, and to really do that work to prepare other white folks to be in a multiracial movement in a way that is a co-conspirator in the work, and to work collaboratively and to allow people of color to lead and to take that leadership and to be accountable when we do it wrong, because that happens regularly. And so that's really what had started Surge. And we started probably like a year later after the initial kind of meetings and organizing work in a public meeting, actually in this very building in the main meeting space up front, and began to have mass meetings on the third Monday of every month, which we still do, and then really trying to create folks, white folks in the community who will utilize their influence in institutions and in places where they have power to disrupt white supremacy in those institutions. So that looks a lot of different ways, and I think we'll talk more about that as we go. But that's kind of how Surge got started, and Surge really works in collaboration with a lot of various organizations here in Kansas City to both connect with and educate and mobilize white people, and to support the work of people of color-led movements like the organizations represented here today.
So I'm supporting Al Hadaf, which is a Palestine advocacy group, and it basically stemmed from the fact that there was a tangible lack of contributions or involvement that were solicited from Palestinians by working groups here in Kansas City. So what we wanted to do was to just create an organization that centered Palestinian voices, because whenever we do talk about Palestine, the Palestinian voice, the narrative of the Palestinian is not contributed, it's not heard. So we wanted to ensure that there was a Palestinian advocacy group here that was run by and led by Palestinians, so that, you know, we could be there for the community as a knowledge source, and for us also to seek knowledge. So what we do is we focus both on the cultural and political aspects of Palestine and Palestinian advocacy. And it's important to do that because whenever we do see Palestine framed in the media, it's usually under the political part, where Palestinians are usually framed as violent or aggressive or perpetrators of like security for Israel. So we wanted to make the Palestinian humanized, because we are human. So we wanted to make it seem more multidimensional, where we celebrated the culture, because Palestine is an ancient land, and the people, the indigenous people, have a deep-rooted cultural history within that land. So to celebrate that culture and for having other people fall in love with that culture is also very important to us. So in addition to the culture, we also focus on politics. Obviously, you have to. I mean, I wouldn't be in the United States if my parents weren't forcibly evicted from Palestine. So we do that by looking at BDS, which is a movement that is very effective, it's very viable, it's very accessible. So I'm going to talk about it a little later. But we kind of use BDS as a political tool for Palestinian liberation and resistance.
So One Struggle KC, we got started in October of 2014. There were several activists that went to Ferguson during the weekend of resistance. And so there was kind of a caravan of folks that went, but we weren't super connected. I know some of the folks are that were in this room too. And we, there were five co-founders, all folks of color. And we started to really just have what the discussions were. Ferguson, people, a lot of folks felt it was over there. A lot of folks that are not from Missouri don't know that Kansas City and St. Louis, we don't have a big solidarity. We're working on that. And to talk about, despite the fact at the time that we had a black police chief who was now the sheriff, which is another discussion, and a black mayor, that we still have issues here. I think a lot of times we think, oh, we have representation, but that doesn't mean that there's actually equity. And so we had conversations, particularly black folk and non-black folk, and folks were like, it's over there, it's not that big of a deal. And we started talking about, like, oh, our police department's actually just as bad. There's been absolutely no indictments of any police officer that has killed anybody in this town, and we also don't have local control of our police. We are the only jurisdiction in the U.S. that has not had control of our police, I believe, since 1922, due to Pendergrass. So we wanted to localize the conversation of what it means for the movement for Black Lives, having that discussion here in Kansas City. Yes, we need to be in solidarity with folks from Ferguson, but Ferguson needs to lead what Ferguson needs, right? And how do we show up for that? But how do we mobilize particularly Black folks here in Kansas City across the spectrum? So not just Black folk that are straight, or Black folk that are religious, or young, or older. What does it mean to have a breadth of Black folks that are queer, straight, otherwise religious and not religious, to talk about the liberation of Black people. Our work started and is rooted in police brutality issues, but we also are talking about what does it mean for liberation, Black folks, just get together, community. We have cookouts in the summer. We've had discussions on Black folk and mental health. So what does it mean to bring folk together to talk about, to center discussions about Blackness here in Kansas City, because oftentimes, like John spoke to earlier, conversations related to race is always usually an education point for other people versus what does it mean to actually bring community together. And we had a lot of white folks that came to One Struggle in the beginning, which was helpful, but at some point it got to the point where we were spending our energy helping the white folks organize white people. And I was like, this defeats the purpose. So I remember the meeting when I went to some of the folks to start, and I was like, listen, y'all got to organize. And how do we do this work? It doesn't mean that we don't ever want to be in collaboration. We don't ever want to be in spaces of solidarity. But we have to do stuff in our communities to get our stuff together in order to know how to work together effectively. Because if not, we're always having cross conversations. It's kind of like counseling or what you're doing with your families, right? Your parents have one conversation, kids have another conversation, and then you come together and you figure it out. So that's where we got started. We're coming up on our 5-year marker. I'm excited to be here. And I'm really happy that y'all came here on a Saturday to talk about digging in, because PeaceWorks has been having this conversation for a long time, and it's kind of come to fruition. So for me, this conversation has been in the works for like 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, great. Thank you all so much for also taking time to speak with us today. So that's actually a good segue into our next question, and I'll give a little bit of background on how we got here today. So I have been doing work with PeaceWorks off and on for several years now. I don't know, 7, 8, something like that. I mean, 7, I think. And really, it you know, from the anti-war stuff, and used to show up to help with Freeing Chelsea Manning and any other kind of stuff that was needed, and however I could help, most of the time it was showing up. And in that time, I've had really great conversations about peace and justice with people in PeaceWorks, and have become very close friends with some people. And so, a couple of years ago, my dear friend Jane and I were talking about leadership and how do we get leaders of color to involved with other groups and other peace activist groups. And so we'd been talking about this, and I had been asked a few times at that point by boards of organizations that were all white, and can you help us out, or your voice is important, and that was all appreciated. But I also had to take a step back and say, well, that's not how it works, right? That's we don't want to tokenize anybody. No one person of color speaks for us all. And really, the way to come together, really the way to get leadership from people of color involved, is to commit, is to understand, educate yourself, understand, and commit to the struggles that people of color face in your community. So committing to that, and when people see that, then you won't have to ask, right? They will want to. We will want to be involved when we're all kind of in the same or similar struggle. And so for the last 2 years, Jane and I have really been having some great conversations and doing some work with how can we bring this idea to the PeaceWorks community? How can we bring it to the peace and justice community? How can we start to have these conversations together? And this is the sort of the first of that of those discussions, which I hope to see that we will have more. In fact, there were, several other racial justice groups that are not represented today that, we didn't have time, and we obviously didn't have space in the panel. So, I mean, I would love to see other groups in the area represented and having discussions with us in the future as well. So, and then we came up with the idea of that, well, race issues are peace issues, and how do we communicate that, right? And so that's what we want to start doing today. We just want to start having this conversation. And I hope that we can take that and, advance that conversation in our own communities and with each other and further our education. I hope there's all kinds of Googling going to be happening and all of that. But I think it's important to know what your neighbor is going through. We have very intense peace issues, peace and justice issues right here in our backyard, and that's really important. Let's kick off with just, and anybody, you don't have to answer if you're not feeling it. If you're feeling a different question, that's fine too. I'd also like to say that no one person here is this absolute expert on the field, right? So you will not be expected. Nobody's going to ask you, so how do we solve the conflict in Palestine? No, that's not going to happen. That's not what we're looking for, right? We're looking for to hear your voices on the experiences of people in your communities and what we're doing here in Kansas City. Why? I've kind of said why, briefly my thoughts on why peace issues are, or race issues are also peace issues in Kansas City and abroad. But for you and for your community, what does that mean to you? What does it mean what is that connection between race, racism, discrimination, systems of oppression, right? What is that connection between those things and the idea of peace here in our communities? Anybody want to take that?
Hello. That would look like families not having to have the fear of being separated, of being deported, of being sent back to a country that, a lot of people that are coming over here, it's because they're running away from a very violent, oppressive government or our neighborhood or whatever it may be. They come here, and then we're kind of stuck in the shadows, having to live with fear every day, and also having to work jobs that exploit the community. When you have to constantly live in fear and look over your shoulder
just because of the color of your skin or because you don't have the 9 little digits that give you protection when you were separated from your family in detention for who knows how long, sometimes without a hearing. It's, you know, as a community, we can't say we're a peaceful community while there's an agency that is terrorizing brown and black communities.
For me, when I think about the idea of peace, I think, and I'll say this full disclosure, I'm on the advisory board for AVILA's Buchanan Peace and Nonviolence Initiative. And I bring up in that space, and I bring up in many spaces, that when we have the discussions about peace and nonviolence, we often have this idea that everything's going to be quote-unquote safe, and we're not going to ruffle any feathers, and we're all just going to get along, and we're going to be happy, and we're going to have rainbows and play outside, right? This all like peace, love, and flowers. But to me, the discussion about nonviolence is a discussion that oftentimes acts as though that violence is only physical. Physical violence is one manifestation of violence, which is usually, it's a symptom of a root foundation, which usually has to do with poverty and oppression. But violence happens in so many levels. It happens on systemic levels. It happens when you can't get into schools because of your documentation status. It happens when I can't walk down the street or somebody can't walk down the street and I can't hold my partner's hand. It happens when we see all these instances across the country where mostly white folk and white women are calling the police on black folks for merely existing, like having a cookout or being outside or whatever, breathing. That is violence. And so we often want to talk about violence as physical. Yes, we can talk about interpersonal violence. We can talk about violence in our communities and out down the street. And all those things are very important. But I think the conversation that we often gloss over is the violence that happens on an everyday level and the violence of silence, the violence of apathy, the violence that it's just, it's your people's problems. That's not my issue. Or I'm one of the good ones. And I am absolved from doing work because I worked on this campaign and I marched with MLK and... That's part of it, but the work is ongoing all day, every day, and it's not only the work that we do within our communities, but it's our deep interpersonal work. And for me, to be free as a black person is to just have a space where I can just be. I can be happy. I can be joyous. I don't have to worry about the BS that's going on. I curse a lot, but I know we're being recorded, so I'm going to try to keep it down a little bit today. And technically, I'm in a church, and I'm a heathen, but that's a whole other discussion. But that I can operate and be unapologetically black, unapologetically queer, unapologetically atheist, unapologetically mixed race black feminist, and that is my space, and I can be in all those spaces at all the time. For me, that's liberation and that's peace. For me as a black person, every black person defines liberation differently, and I also acknowledge that I'm a mixed race black woman. I have a lot of privileges in this world, and I know that folks that I, when I'm doing this work, that my duty is to make sure that folks look different than me, who are darker than me, or might have an accent, or might be shorter, different body size, or different ability, that they also have the same opportunities that I have. That I'm not just that safe Negro. I'm the token Negro that does the work. That is my duty to make sure that the liberation of black folks that don't look like me is also wrapped up in my liberation.
You're amazing. So for me, what really stood out for me as a Palestinian activist was what was going on in Ferguson. And that's when I realized that, obviously, I'm Palestinian, so the whole issue of Palestine really hits home for me because it is home. So when the Ferguson protests came out, and that is when I saw that true peace, you know, the whole like saying like no justice, no peace. So true peace comes when all of us truly come together. And I realized that because as a Palestinian, when I saw at Ferguson protesters were getting tear gassed by the St. Louis Police Department, Palestinians from Gaza and Palestinians that are living in the occupied territories that have been tear gassed by the Israeli forces, those Palestinians would tweet out from Palestine to Ferguson or from Gaza to Ferguson telling protesters in Ferguson who have been tear gassed by the St. Louis police force how to deal with the tear gas, like put milk or something like that, like put rags of milk on your eyes or something like that. So like I realized that our movements are so very intersectional. So when we talk about police brutality here, I want to mention that the police departments in the United States have been trained by the Israeli Defense Forces. And the Israeli Defense Forces that incarcerate children for absolutely no reason as a fear tactic to prevent them from resisting their own oppression, or the Israeli department that separates families as a fear tactic to not resist against their own oppression. The open-air prison in Gaza where people can't leave or come in without Israel's permission, people committing suicide because they're so hopeless in Gaza. Like, all of that, all of the things that we see here in the United States, they're happening to the people in Palestine too, which is why, for me as a Palestinian activist, intersectionalism has to be at the forefront of whatever it is that we're doing. We have to talk to different communities and see what they're going through and how we can help. Because although like our struggles are different, they're still so very similar and they're still tied to this thing. And for me, I don't know, that's where I find my justice and that's where I find my peace, is by working with other people of color. So yeah, that's it for me.
So they all said it really powerfully. I don't want to add too much, but I will say that, you know, as white folks involved in this work, it's really easy for us to compartmentalize and to define peace in very narrow ways that make us feel comfortable. And particularly when we are in a space where we are leading a conversation, if true justice is going to happen, then we have to be taking leadership and following the leadership of people of color-led work. If we're not doing that work, if we're not listening and centering the voices of the other panelists here and their organizations and their fight, then we are going to mess it up. We are going to claim peace when that's not happening because of our privilege and the ways in which we have the luxury to overlook or to turn ourselves away or to define things that there's a victory in ways that it's by far not happening. And so if we really want to work for peace, then we have to remain pushing ourselves into uncomfortable places of looking at the ways in which white supremacy is showing up in John, because believe me, it still does, and the ways that white supremacy is showing up within the institutions where I frequent, whether that be my faith community, whether that be my employment, my family, you know, those type of things. And we have to constantly push ourselves into uncomfortable spaces, being accountable and following the leadership of people of color who are leading the fight for liberation.
Thank you. Thank you all for weighing in on that. What? Just one last thought to that. It always, kind of on what Summer was saying, it never connected with me. I always found this disconnection in when I would work within the peace activist community here in Kansas City. And I could very clearly see the similarities to having fought in the Iraq War. Some of the conditions, the policing, the militarization, all of that, I could see it, and I could see it a lot here in Kansas City among in communities of color with militarized police, and it never made sense to me. Why are these peace activists? Why we're so anti-war, but this is happening here, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse, and you know, that's why we need to have these conversations. It's kind of like a perspective, bringing in sometimes, you know, when people say, oh, you're too close to the project, I think that people can be too far away, can have a bigger view when it's like, okay, this part of us is sick, this part of my community is sick, you know, what can I do here? Is this more impactful than what I'm doing half the world away, or my intentions half the world away? Not saying that that's not important, but can we do both? So I think I'd like to move on to, and during this whole time, ask each other questions if you want to. It's fine. And we don't even have to discuss my questions, just a jumping off point to prove I'm a little professional. But right now, I'd like to go into part of the program where I discuss with each of our speakers specific questions relating to their work and their communities. And we will have about 20 minutes for questions at the end from the audience, so please hold your questions. I guess I'll just start off with Diane with one struggle. We've already talked a little bit about policing. We know that there is wildly disproportionate mass incarceration. You mentioned something about the school-to-prison pipeline. And how, you know, violence shows up systemically, right? Violence shows up with through accessibility, even to food, healthcare, education, those kinds of things. So, if we could, could you talk about more around why is it that cash bail system is important? What to get rid of that? How does that affect people of color? Or I'd also like to talk about how we hear a lot of things, I've heard a lot of things from black folks around respectability politics, right? What does that mean? What does that mean? How have you seen that play out in black culture? And you know, why is it important for black activists and black people to carve out and their own spaces, whether that's for activism, education, or just living, you know, living life?
So I'll start with the cash bail system. We don't have to do a raise of hands, but just think, probably most of us drive. If we don't drive, we access the world in some way, shape, or form. You've been in a car. Think about a time that you probably most of the people in the room have been pulled over. Think about how many tickets you've gotten out of, how many warnings you've gotten. You don't have to put your hands up, but I would say probably most of the folks in the room have gotten pulled over at some point in time and got a warning and didn't get a ticket. And then if you have, think about what it was like when you went to the court. How many of y'all have been in court, whether it was for you or supporting somebody else? And most of the folks in that room are black and brown, right? And we get caught up in this system. And, you know, the Ferguson report showed, and I would love to have a local report of how much money this city brings in with our traffic tickets. But you go to most any traffic court across this country, and you see disproportionates of black and brown, and particularly low-income folk that get caught in the system, lose our traffic tickets, lose our driver's license because of tickets, and then we can't work, we can't go to school, we don't have childcare, right? So that's just the traffic system, let alone bails, warrants, having warrants. Most people, a friend of mine's sister did not know she had a warrant for an unpaid ticket until she got pulled over and she spent a night in jail because of that, right? That these are put into budgets, and we know that police officers have quotas. We all see them out, Main Street, right down the street. Pulling folks over at the end of the month, right? It's kind of an unfortunate joke, is that we know people are getting pulled over at the end of the month because they got to meet their quotas, just like a used car salesperson. Got to meet your quotas to get folk tickets so you can pay for things. There is a report, and it's a few years old, but also about search and seizures, about how many police departments, how it's just common knowledge of what types of rage you'll do because of the stuff you'll get out of it. Big screen TVs, electronics, right? It's just a grab, right? How is that not gang activity, right? So it's all about what we frame as what is legal and what is not. And so the idea, too, that everything punitive damages are done through money, right? A capitalist system, and that people oftentimes are not given community service, and we're not given, you know, probation is extended again and again and again. What does it look like to actually do restorative justice, to actually have conversations when you're actually doing community work? If you do harm in your community, what does it mean to stay in community and do the work versus just having to pay all these ridiculous fines?
So it's just a piece of it. I feel like that's a whole other workshop that we can get into. But the second part of the question was about respectability. So, and this is not a shaming. How many of y'all have not heard of the term respectability politics? Okay, about half. I would figure about half in the room. So the idea of respectability politics, at least for me, black folk and black community, is the idea that can't ruffle feathers. And I often talk about how this happens in the Midwest with Midwest Nice, that we just always have to be nice. We don't want to make anyone mad. We don't want to be disrespectful. We need to respect authority at all times. Who defines even what authority is? And because of that is often a detriment to the work that we really need to be done. So a unfortunate prime example, and this was not locally, but you might have been paying attention if you've been on social media the last few days, there, and this happens intra-community, right? White supremacy affects all people. White supremacy affects white folk losing their culture, losing their heritage. John will talk more about that. But it also affects communities of color, and particularly in black folks, it plays out in colorism, the idea that lighter is better and closer to whiteness, that having the straighter hair is closer to whiteness. But also it plays out the ways in which that what the idea is that white folks are always watching black folks. And if we are too disruptive, that white folks will see and keep us in check. So for an example, there is a principal, and I don't remember her name, in Texas, who this last week put a memo out to the parents and gave them a dress code and said folks could not wear leggings, bonnets, which is a silk over your hair, right? Leggings, bonnets, pajamas. I think those are the three things that she outlawed, right? So that you cannot, she turned away a parent, I think, from enrolling her daughter in school because she didn't meet the dress code. Sent her away. What does that have to do with education? Right, and this is black folks doing this to other black folks. And also, mind you, a black woman doing it to another black woman, right? So I know having a conversation in a predominantly non-black community, this is very much a black community conversation, but it's an example of the way respectability politics plays out. Another way that it plays out within activism is here locally. When we got started, we were out in the streets, and we had white folk and black folk, like, why y'all, just don't disrupt. Why are y'all walking in the streets? Why do you have a blue horn? You just need to go out and vote. Just wait for the election, right? Just wait for the election. It'll be fine. We got a black police chief. We got a black mayor. Why are you cursing at the police? Why are the police killing us? Why are you worried about my language with the police when the police are killing us, right? The ways in which we are taught to be respectable, but it really doesn't allow us to be our true, because we have justified anger. Most people in this room, y'all should be justifiably angry about many of the injustices. And if we are not given space to actually talk about the ways that anger is manifests in many different ways, then we keep it controlled in, and we're always like battling with ourselves about what we can and what we can't do. And it's a detriment to our movement. So this happens, like I said, within black communities. It happens cross generations. It happens within faith communities and non-faith communities. You know, there's kind of the myth that, like, you know, a lot of churches were behind MLK. Most weren't. Most black churches in this community, churches were not out in the streets with us. The churches were not talking about this in their congregation. It was happening in the streets, and most pastors won't come out because the idea is if we let our folk go out, they might not come back in, and where's our money going to go because we have to pay our bills? It's a whole other discussion. But the idea is that, like, activism can happen in many ways, and I think the idea of respectability politics gives us the idea that activism is only happening through voting, through contacting your local congressperson, by having maybe a community meeting, and that's about it. But activism looks in many ways, shapes, or form, and there's not just one way to be an activist in our communities. And respectability politics teaches us that there are only certain ways to do it, to disrupt, and anything else is seen as too aggressive, too angry, too this, put a whatever, when white folk have been doing that all the time, raising hell, and then suddenly when black and folk do it, and we're like, oh, you just need to be quiet. Just wait, it'll be fine. Things are much better than they were in the 60s. I think there are probably some elders in the room be like, maybe yes, maybe no. So for me, that's where respectability politics plays out. The last point I'll put, because I want to pass it on, the last point I put is respectability plays out particularly regarding sexuality and gender. That women are seen as having particular gender roles, and that the idea that our movements need to be held by straight black men,
right? Black men are welcome in this movement, but it needs to look a certain way. And then also the ideas that straight folks are the stuff doing that. And most of the frontline folk forever have been transgender women, have been queer folks, and have been young people, have always been at the forefront of social movements, but they're not who makes the media. There's not, that's usually not makes it in our history books. So respectability politics acts as only certain people should get the headline, certain people should be written in history, when it's actually those on the front lines are the most marginalized and often at the biggest risk of literally putting our bodies on the line.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. right now I'd like to move over to John with Surge, and really I think that there's still a lot of people, you'll have people nod their heads and kind of get it when we say, you know, it's important for, you know, white people to educate other white people sure. on systemic racism and power dynamics, those kinds of things. But I mean, I've even had my friends when I said, "Hey, why don't you go to Surge, or why don't you talk with your, you know, with your white friends about this?" And you know, I've had people say, "Well, why? When I have you to do it, right? Like, I want to hear it from you, right from the horse's mouth, so to speak." But so those kinds of things, I've also seen and personally experienced the work from Surge in protest events, in very intense situations, as an accomplice. And I say this, and I think a lot of people in this room have heard me before saying, I am not interested in an ally, mm-hmm. I want an accomplice. I want someone who is going to stand in the gap. You know what that means? Like, mm-hmm. stand between me and the police. I want someone who's going to de-arrest me, you know, whatever that means. That means you gotta, you know, whatever you have to do. A lot of people here have bailed me out of jail several times. Mm-hmm. A lot of people here have been very supportive of those things. I've also seen Surge say, you know, this particular protest that we're doing or that we're involved with is led by and it's for and about people of color. How can we help? And they've provided a lot of the logistical things, a lot of the ancillary support, you know, and have actually volunteered to be the communicators between the police and the activists. And I think that's what showing up is. So if you could talk a little, I just want to like put that there. Mm-hmm. If you could talk a little bit about why is it important for white folk to engage with each other? And what does it mean to support people of color as white activists?
Sure, yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I think as we've talked a lot about, I mean, you know, white folks, we have a lot of privilege in the community. And like I said earlier, we can choose to look away from these moments when we want to. If we feel uncomfortable or we feel agitated to a place, we can, you know, I always say we can belly back up to the bar of white supremacy and we'll be welcomed back with open arms. And so it's important that that we take responsibility because of that, because of our privilege and because of the ways in which we have that freedom and that luxury, that we stay pushing ourselves to be in spaces where we are working with each other, that we are doing that hard work of helping move each other along, agitating each other, but doing it in a way where we push each other to stay involved, to stay at the table. You know, one of the big myths in racial justice work, particularly for white people, is that there is a good and a bad white person, and the reality is that doesn't exist. That we are all poisoned by white supremacy. We are infected with the disease of white supremacy that infects every aspect of our culture and our society. And so, like, for us to, sometimes when we want to be, you know, hanging and in solidarity with people of color, a lot of times that's centering ourselves as being the good white person. You know, I don't need to hang with y'all, you know, y'all folks that are getting it wrong, that are screwing it up, y'all are the problems, other white people, but I got this figured out, and so I'm going to go hang with Lucky and Diane and others, you know, because we got this figured out. And when y'all get your stuff together, I had to catch myself. When y'all get your stuff together, you can come on over here and join us. But the reality is that is, once again, just reinforcing a system of white supremacy, of us othering people in different ways and placing ourselves as some arrived hero. You know, Angela Davis calls it heroic individualism. And we're all drawn to that in particular movement work. And that's why it's important that we really deconstruct the good, bad binary, and that there aren't no good white people, right? And some of us are squirming when we hear that. Well, you know, I thought I was, but no, we're not. We're just white folks that are trying to figure it out in different ways. And, you know, I look at it as like being involved in anti-oppression work is like riding up particularly when you have privilege, it's like riding up the down escalator. When you quit moving, when you feel like you can take a pause and you got this figured out and you're congratulating yourself and you're waving around the corner, you're moving backwards. It's taking you back down. You're sinking back down into a place of getting comfortable. And that usually means you're getting ready. You're like, you know, the sort of the old adage, pride becomes before the fall, right? I mean, I know that maybe is worn out, but that's sort of what it is. You begin to feel like you've figured something out, and that's where you're going to probably make the mistake, where you're going to, you know, create a microaggression or harm someone or collude with white supremacy in some way that you probably won't even realize while you're still feeling good about your involvement. And that we have to stay uncomfortable. We have to push ourselves. And it's our responsibility to work with other white folks because we have influence in our communities. You know, I grew up in a working class community in Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, when I first got involved in racial justice work, you know, I would think to myself, well, I don't have any power. You know, who am I? I'm kind of a poor working class kid. I can't do much. And the reality is that was false. Like, I have plenty of power and situatedness in different organizations, in different spaces, in different communities. And so I have to take that responsibility to speak up and speak out. But also, like I said, to do it in a way that calls people in, right? Once again, not sort of distancing myself, but saying, hey, here's the ways in which we're getting this wrong. And we have to commit to continuing to push ourselves to be better, to do better, and to take feedback and accountability from the people of color in our life, but not to sit back. Like I said earlier, we have to take that leadership. We have to say, what is the way in which showing up is most useful to people of color in this moment, and then following that leadership, but not sitting back waiting for step-by-step instructions, you know, because that's not helpful either, because that then overburdens folks of saying, okay, I brought the water, now I'm going to stand here and wait for Diane's next instruction. You know, like, that's not what that means either. It means us taking risks, us taking initiative to make change and speak out, but doing it in a way that represents the strategy and learning that strategy, listening and hearing from people of color of this is the strategy, this is what we need. And then being smart enough to learn from that, take that, listen to it, and push forward in a way that honors that strategy, that honors the spirit of what is needed in that moment. And to use our privilege to put ourselves in the way, as Lucky mentioned, you know, because the reality is, a cop is gonna react really differently to me than any of these other panelists up here today. And so I need to then take that risk and put myself in that place when that is what's needed. But it's also about paying attention to if that is needed, because if I put myself in an agitational place with the police in ways that is not needed, then all of a sudden I endanger the folks that I'm trying to be in co-collaboration with, to be a conspirator, to be an accomplice, and that then creates more danger and more harm than good.
Awesome, thank you. I'd like to move on. I'm sorry if I'm like going a little fast. We're just catching up a little bit. I'd like to move on to talking with Summer, with El Hadaf on the work that you do and kind of issues that Palestinians are facing, and also what's happening here to build community. But just to lay us down, another Angela Davis reference. Angela Davis, after a delegation to Palestine, compared the experience of Palestinian people to people who lived under Jim Crow, to people who lived under the South African apartheid, and to indigenous people in the United States living on reservations. And so I wanted to like put that in as kind of the level of how we're thinking about this, and that it is a shame that we don't even get we don't get very much of the media, right? We don't receive most of the truth here at all. And so that's also something that we struggle with as peace activists who are supporters. But it's just like this huge conflict from British colonization, major civil wars, to major uprisings, groups like PLO, Hamas, genocide of like half the people. International law put in place that has been ignored, simply ignored by Western governments, by the United States, by Israel. The fact that I think, as Summer mentioned it before, there is in Gaza, it's like the biggest open air prison in the world. And not to mention over 7 million refugees fleeing and being displaced from their homes because of extreme violence and political inaction. So I would like, if you could, talk about, maybe break down a little bit more about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and why is that important? Why is that important here for us? And how can Palestinians, how are Palestinians building community and power here? And then if you could touch on a lot of people that I've talked to, just having personal conversations, have asked or said, I'm very supportive of the Palestinian movements and it's a disgrace what people are going through. How do I show that support without being anti-Semitic, right? What does it mean to support Palestinians and want justice for Palestine, while also not being anti-Jewish? Can you talk about that?
Okay, so I'm gonna start off. I'm gonna start off by talking about BDS first. So, like you said, a lot of people, and including me, so South African apartheid and the Israeli apartheid are very similar. So it's based on ethnicity. Israel has this law. So essentially, like, there are tiers of citizenship. And the best tier that you can be is the nation only, like a national, which is what I also like to call like Jewish only. So they have citizenship based on your ethnicity. They have roads based on your ethnicity. They have hospital wards based off your ethnicity. Land is cut up based off your ethnicity. And another intersectional point is the apartheid wall that they like to call the security fence. It literally separates families. So, and that's based off of ethnicity. So BDS, it loosely stems from, it's called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. And it's loosely based off of South African apartheid, the movement against South African apartheid. And what it was is that it was established in 2005 by Palestinian civil society. And it's essentially calling for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions of companies that help to keep the repressive system that Israel has, to basically punish them in some kind of way, economically. So, for example, we have companies like HP, Caterpillar, HP with security, Caterpillar with demolishing Palestinian homes, G4S for security, Victoria's Secret, what else? L'Oreal, like a bunch of stuff. Oh my God, how did I forget that? Sabra Hummus, how many of you guys, don't raise your hand, but how many of you guys eat that? So Sabra Hummus, it's Sabra was a refugee camp of Palestinians that was massacred by Israeli forces. And for them to name it after a massacre, you're essentially eating bloody hummus. It is what it is. So being aware of what you're consuming as a consumer, what you're buying, that is really the point of BDS. So BDS, it targets companies that help to maintain Israel's repressive system, like I said, via occupation. It targets companies that work on illegal settlements, which are only growing. And it targets companies that export and import goods to and from Israel. So there is a list. You guys can check it out. I think it's called bdslist.org. Just make sure that you're being a conscientious consumer. So that's what BDS is. And Palestinians have definitely utilized that, and it's definitely been very successful. So Palestinians have used BDS, and it's become extremely successful, which has scared the Israeli government, obviously. And we've seen most of the success of BDS stem from academia. So college campuses, the American Academy Association has endorsed it. So it's been very successful, and it has scared the Israeli government a lot. So what it is that when people talk about supporting BDS or supporting the Palestinian movement and being afraid of coming off as anti-Semitic, that doesn't make sense to me and other Palestinian activists, because when you think of anti-Semitism, it's hatred or bigotry or prejudice against an individual, like of Jews, right? But when we're talking about BDS and we're talking about Palestinian liberation, we are critiquing validly the repressive Israeli policies. And Israel isn't an individual. Israel is a government, right? So when you're talking about when you're talking about human rights and the freedom of an indigenous population, you can't throw that word out so casually. You can't throw out that word like, oh, that's anti-Semitic, to fight for the liberation of the Palestinian people, because that really just tarnishes the meaning of what anti-Semitism is. Anti-Semitism has led to horrible things like the Holocaust. And for us to say that us critiquing a government, not an individual, a government that has racist policies against another ethnic group, that's not anti-Semitic. That's you fighting for justice. And it's their way of sabotaging valid critique, legitimate critique against Israel. And it's their way of trying to censor valid critique against Israel. They've used that against Palestinians. I mean, I was asked for my last name today, and I was too scared to say it, because if my name does get out, I won't be able to go and visit my family in Palestine, because they do that. They target Palestinian activists who use BDS. So it's not anti-Semitic if you're fighting for Palestinian liberation. You're not targeting an individual based off of their ethnicity. You're fighting against the repressive policies that one government has put in place against an indigenous population. So I'll talk about, Al-Hadaf is fairly new. So it's important to build up the Palestinian community everywhere, because the Palestinian diaspora community is worldwide. Like Lucky said, I mean, 7 million refugees have come out of what Palestinians call the Nakba, which is the catastrophe, since 1948, and it's ongoing. Like, my father was a part of that in 1948, and he still remembers it. So it's like very recent. So I don't know how we have been so actively brainwashed to forget something that has happened that is so recent. So it's very important to help uplift the Palestinian community, because Palestinians are fighting against occupation. Palestinians are fighting for the right of return. Palestinians are fighting for equal rights. And when we look at media, what you don't see are Palestinians. So again, the onslaughts of Gaza, there have been a bunch by Israel. And Gaza is mainly a citizen population. Like, there is no military. Hamas is the government. It is not a military. It's this population that is, millions upon millions of people are squeezed into this tiny piece of land, right? And they're throwing bombs into this land. And they're just like, whoever gets killed gets killed. Like, no, that's not right. So it's important that when we have conversations about Palestine, Palestinians are in those conversations. Because like I was saying, so in the media, when we had those onslaughts on Gaza, when I was looking on CNN, when I was looking at different news channels, the people that were there on that were on the station, I don't know what to call it, they were white experts on the area. So where were the Palestinians? Israelis were being represented, but where were the Palestinians? So it's extremely important to make sure that Palestinians are in these conversations, all your conversations, honestly, because like I said, the Palestinian struggle is a very intersectional one. It's very intersectional. We got the wall, we got mass incarceration, we got it all. So just ensure that Palestinians are a part of the conversation, especially when it pertains to Palestine.
Thank you.
It's very powerful.
Now, speaking of refugees and immigration, I'd like to talk with Deanna, with AIR. If you could talk a little bit about what the experiences have been for families locally or in this area for undocumented families, what that process looks like when, you know, you mentioned the fear earlier, but what does the process look like when somebody does get picked up? And kind of like, what are those conditions? What are people fleeing from and what do they stand to return to? And I think that will kind of lay out what the connection of what undocumented people, what refugees here are connecting that with what the detention centers down at the southern border. And just the fact that we have detention centers, we have modern day concentration camps full of brown babies. Let that sink in for a minute, right? That is happening in the United States right now. And it's still happening because we still don't have enough people to destroy it, right? Or who are willing to. So think about that. And if you could give us some insight on the impacts of that.
Hello. So one, I think it is important to connect those two and to remember that what's happening at the border is also happening here. There's also that family separation that's happening here in our own communities, in our own backyard. Last summer when it was first coming to light, because it's been happening for a long time, the Department of Homeland Security has always had the discretion whether they would separate someone from their parent or not when they turn themselves over at the border. So it's not anything new that has been happening. The experiences that have been happening here have been, they're vast. People have been detained because of a simple traffic violation, and the police has worked with ICE and turned them over to immigration. You know, the person was just driving and they happened to have a taillight that was out, so they get pulled over. And then that was, you know, that was a radical shift that happened in the families, that happened to the family. We've seen in Johnson County, it's been particularly bad. Because the police is actively working with immigration, the Johnson County courts has an internal policy that if any of their employees suspect that someone there is undocumented, whether they're traffic court, family court, whatever court they may be, if someone suspects that they're undocumented, they call immigration. So that's an internal policy. That's like the employees are encouraged to do that. And we've seen, especially in Olathe, that if someone gets a traffic ticket, they go and pay it. 2 weeks later, ICE is at their door picking them up, right? And we've seen targets more specifically in Olathe. There's a lot of apartment complexes that have been raided, and people have just been picked up because they, you know, they have brown skin or they look a certain type of way. Immigration has just been going up to them, asking them for their papers and taking them if they haven't provided them, right? So there has been a lot of ways that people have been caught up in the system, and although it's been bad, it has gotten worse, because in 2017, the administration, President Trump, signed an executive order that pretty much broadened who is a priority for deportation. So although deportation and detention was bad under the Obama era, it was really high, is the highest it's ever been. They were giving discretion, and people who didn't have any criminal records, who had citizen children, who have been here, who were members of the community, were allowed to stay here under under deferment. But that went out the window as soon as this executive order was signed. So people who have had prior deportations but were under that that deferment were picked up at their ICE check-ins, were picked up at their homes, and were deported, right? So that meant that, so that executive order pretty much means anyone who is here undocumented, even if they've been here for years, even if they have citizen children, even they don't have a criminal record, they are a priority for deportation. So now it's, we're, you know, that pretty much opens up for anyone to be deported and detained. And what we've seen and what isn't good about that is that although there's been increase in ICE arrest, there has been decrease in actual deportation. So people are actually spending more time in detention centers. And we know that's the case because it's a this is all a for-profit detention, like, right? This is all for-profit. As if you have people in your beds, then you're getting more money. The CoreCivic, who owns most of the detention centers around the country and operates prison facilities around the country, and they also contract out to local and county jails, they reported the $1.8 billion in revenue in 2017. That's billions of dollars, right, that they're making for people, like, that they're making for people that are just because they're undocumented and they don't have Social Security. So I think that's why we are definitely seeing brown kids at the border that are being detained, because there's money in that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of power and money right now. I hope that we can fight towards a future where that's not the case and we actually fight for the humanity of people. But until that's the case, that's why we, AIR is actually building a support system, because Congress isn't gonna fix this anytime soon, and as much as we can pressure them, I hope to God that, and I hope to the universe, that the elections come out different in 2020. Because as soon as he came into office and as soon as Jeff Sessions was appointed, he came and just destroyed all of the protections that asylum seekers, that refugees, that immigrants have. He cut everything in half. Immigration judges now have a higher quota. They have to have, they have to rule a certain amount of cases per year, and that increased. So they're not able to look at every single case and really look at it well, right? Because they're just like, okay, we've seen this before. And if you've gone to an immigration court and witness, you can see like that disconnect between the judges and the cases that they're actually hearing. They don't really care. They don't care to hear what the actual case. They just kind of, they have to fill their quota, so they just have to move along quickly. And so, kind of to talk a little bit about the process of immigration detention. And there's two separate ones, because it's different from when you're coming across a border and seeking asylum. And then there's the one where you are picked up here in the community and have already been here. That's the one I'm gonna speak on, because that's what I'm most experienced in. So we see that when someone is picked up, they're taken to a processing center. The processing center is up north and then they're sent out to a county jail. So Kansas and Missouri, what makes them a little bit different than other parts of the country is that we don't have a detention center for just immigrants. ICE contracts out to different county jails, which is problematic because those county jails are usually 2-3 hours away, inaccessible. So the people that are detained don't really have access to legal counsel. They don't sometimes can't even talk to their families because the phones communications are so unreliable, and they also cost a lot of money. Their calls outside of the prison are really expensive. So they can't access very many, actually any resources. And Kansas and Missouri don't really have any programs. Like the East and the West Coast, they have so many resources in the detention centers and jails for people to be able to access. So that's something we're trying to build on, but slowly but surely. So they're taken to the county jails, and they're either given a bond by ICE or they're not. Now, most everyone is they have a right to a bond if they depending on certain criteria. The thing about the bonds that is that the person has to pay that upfront in cash, and the lowest it can be is $1,500. But we've seen the average is $5,000, $7,000. ICE gives bonds of $15,000, $20,000. And if it is that high, the individual does have the right to get a bond hearing in front of an immigration judge to ask to lower it. But that is usually 2 weeks, 3 weeks. We've seen an increase in wait for those, right? So they're stuck in the jails until they can get that hearing. But then the families aren't able to afford those bonds, right? And when you don't have access to legal counseling, you don't even have access really to your family. Like, how are you supposed to fight your deportation case if you're kind of just left out in the dark? And there was actually just a study that came out recently that as of July 2018, ICE has $204 million in bonds from people who have paid it. And so the way you get bonds back, the immigration bonds especially, because you don't get them back until your case is complete. That usually takes 2-3 years, depending on the case. And usually families are in a very chaotic place in their life, so they just find whoever they can to pay the bond. Because it has to be a resident or a citizen or someone with status to pay the bond. And a lot of the families don't have anyone, so they reach out to whoever they can find, right? So a lot of these families aren't getting that money that they paid back. So then, you know, you're kind of left back in this poverty, like harsh poverty cycle, where you just had to pay thousands of dollars to get your family member back. And then you also have to pay legal fees. You have to pay application fees to the US government. They have really made it impossible to be able to live a safe, dignified life, especially if you're caught up in the immigration system. I really think immigration is, they're going out and they're kidnapping our community members, holding them for ransom, because this is really what it is. They're taking them for no reason, and they're saying, give us this amount of money, and then we'll give them back if you do. But you might or might not get your money back. Like, they're holding people for ransom in our in the county jails. And I think what's worse is that, so the whole immigration system, it's a civil conviction. But it's under the executive order, right? It's under the executive branch. You would think an immigration court would be under the judicial branch, but it's not. So the ICE agents, the immigration judges, their boss is Trump, pretty much. It was Jeff Sessions when he was in that. But so you have a super anti-immigrant person in charge telling people what to do and how to really sorry I'm losing my train of thought. So I know, I think we're almost out of
time.
No,
you got it. Thank you. That's a lot.
So we need to fight, like, I'll just kind of end it saying, like, we need to fight to, one, move the immigration court and the whole immigration process out of the executive branch, and give a path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented people that are here that are members of a community. And we also have to provide a timely, humane, and safe process as people are migrating here, right? Because we've seen that the way it's set up now, it's not working for anyone, and that's how we have families that are in detention, children that are in detention. That's how we get children that are separated from their parents, because our current immigration system was set up to keep brown and black people from coming here. And I can go, if you all want to know a little bit more about that, I'm doing a workshop against the reflections of white supremacy and immigration law after this. So I'll kind of end it there.
Thank you. And I'll list out after our Q&A all of the workshops and the breakouts that are going to happen. Real quick, to wrap up before we take questions from the audience, please feel free to give us any last thoughts that you might have, what your groups have coming up. But I really would like to know, how can peace activists, how can white people for racial justice join and commit to the fight for your people? And what is that? What could that look like? What is most helpful? And you know, sometimes what is most helpful is space or not engaging a certain way, right? So if you could talk a little bit about what is it that how can people get involved and how can we commit? And any last thoughts that you might have.
So I'm gonna speak to black folks first, because I'm black. And I'm here for black people and folk of color. So for black folk, I think all of us are working at building communities, right? And so for black folk, when I say I'm talking about the diaspora, I'm not talking about just African Americans. There is a disconnect between African immigrants and Caribbean immigrants and folks that are born here. That's white supremacy, right? To have connections with other black folks across the diaspora, to have conversations within our different generations, and also to make and unapologetically have our communities. So when we have our spaces and we have our black spaces, I usually have a white people whisperer there to be like, white person, go to search. And to hold that line, because we operate, this is a hyper-segregated city, we operate in so many spaces where we can't be us. If white folks can't let us be ourselves for 2 hours, they're not really an accomplice. They're really there to just watch, right? And so for black folk that are trying to build community, like, we're often the token of other folk. We might be dating folk that are not black, that we are like their black friend, or their black partner, or they got black kids, hold that space. I have many friends that are interracial relationships, and their white partners or non-black partners know to give them that space, hopefully, to be with other black people, because we always feel like we have to have somebody else with us. No, it's for us and by us. For folks that are non-black, for non-black folk of color,
talk about anti-blackness in your communities, because that is white supremacy. That's a whole other discussion, but we can't act like it doesn't exist. And it happens in our activist circles as well, that for non-black folk of color is very alluring to cozy up to white folk and white power and white money, while we dis and get rid of and discard and use black folks to get up for money and access to the communities. For white folk, talk to other white folk, quit appropriating our stuff. Don't wear our clothes, our music, our hair. Don't drop an N-bomb. I don't care who allowed you to come to the cookout. Don't ever say the N-word. That is a conversation that we have in black spaces. Black folk can own and can decide when and where we're going to use it. Don't use that word. And non-black folk, don't use that word. And I encourage you, John said, to build with other white folk. I think oftentimes folks want to cozy up and get to know black and brown folks, and that's okay, but if you are not doing that much work of agitating your friends, your family, your coworkers, your faith spaces, do that work first and do the internalized work first before you come and want to have a black friend. Because we know when it's authentic or not. Build that space. And if you're agitating, if someone deleted you on Facebook, if someone threatened to cut you out the will, take some real risks. If you threaten to get fired, then I'm willing to throw down with white folks that are willing to do that work. But if you're not, I'm probably not going to hold space with you. That's just for me as a black person doing this work. So that's for me. And get liberation and joy. Black folk, we can be happy. That's why I got Black Joy. This is Black Men Smile, this organization, to talk about what it means for black men to actually be joyous and smiling, because black folk are, but we are demonized in the media. So center and hold black joy and liberation.
Thank you.
Oh, Lord. Sorry. We're literally flipping a table.
I would say... give space to Palestinians. And like I said, the movement for Palestinian liberation is very intersectional. So what you were probably talking about, Palestinians are probably going through. So also be aware, like I said, of what you're consuming. One of the things that I forgot to mention was Airbnb. Airbnb is on the list as inconvenience to my life when I'm traveling, but it's an inconvenience I'll take, you know, because they have homes on settlements, illegal settlements. And for white folks, when Palestinians are telling you that you're normalizing with Zionists because you want to see both sides, there is no both sides when you have the oppressed and you have the oppressor. You have one side, and it's the right side, and it's the side of the oppressed. So when Palestinians are telling you, don't talk to the Zionist group because you don't need to, first of all, don't invite me to speak with a Zionist, because I'm not going to waste my energy, my mental health, and my existence that they're trying to actively deny. I'm not going to do that. Don't invite them. And when Palestinians tell you that, listen. You know, it's our narrative, and it's something we control. So don't try and be devil's advocate, and don't try to be open-minded about something that is so wrong. Essentially, and that's what I have to say.
I'm gonna piggyback on that and also say, don't invite an immigrant to a space where there's gonna be an ICE agent or a police. I've seen groups that try to bring an ICE official, DHS official, to be on a panel to try to get their perspective. We have seen what they are doing. And I would say, most importantly, don't play into the narrative of the good versus the bad immigrant. We're all humans. We all have flaws. And, you know, that shouldn't determine whether you get to live a safe, dignified life, free of the fear of being separated from your home. We're also not victims. Don't think of, the poor immigrants. No, we're resilient people, right? We sacrificed everything to come to give our families a better home. We're resilient people. We're not poor immigrants. Like everyone has mentioned, give us the space to tell our stories and to talk about our experiences and to come up with ideas and how to push back.
I think first and foremost that particularly those of us who are white in the room need to sit with the stories that we've heard today. Sit with those things, and in the places where you find yourself most uncomfortable, actually focus on that, because that is the space where you will grow, where you will fight through the white supremacy that is trying to win out in your spirit. And then read and educate yourself in whatever that is. Continue to dive into it. Do your homework. Don't seek out to people of color to take care of you when you feel uncomfortable. Build relationships and accountable and agitational relationships with other white people who are on this journey or committed to this as well. And when you feel that uncomfortableness, when you feel agitated, seek out those conversations first with other white folks to be able to press each other and hold each other accountable so that we aren't burdening people of color with the emotional labor of taking care of us. Because once again, that just reinforces white supremacy in so many different ways. And then join movement work that's happening here. Surge is one, I think, important way, obviously, if I'm sitting up here talking about it, that you can do that. There's lots of different ways to engage with the work of Surge, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that here shortly. But obviously it isn't the only way. There's other ways, and the important thing is to be in open and accountable relationships with other white people, as well as to have authentic and accountable relationships with people of color in your life that you are doing this work, and then to take those risks, as was mentioned here today, to put yourself in a position to have consequences, because if we're not doing that, then we're too comfortable. So anyway, thank you.
All right, thank you all very much. Before we take a couple of questions from the audience, I would like to go through and let you know which workshops and deeper discussions we have. So in case you have a question that might relate to that might be better suited for that bigger discussion. In this room, after a break and after the Q&A, John will be in this room, and he will be talking about his session is on principles for mobilizing white folks for racial justice. So that will be in this room. In the library, which is out the hall and to the left, I think first door on the left, Deanna with AIR will be talking about, her workshop is around reflections of white supremacy in immigration law, past, present, and future. So if you had interest in what she was talking about of laws and regulations here and nationally, and that would be a good session for you. The next room is the conference room, and it's also on the left, second door on the left. Diane will be in there, and she will be talking about accessibility and inclusion in the arts. So how do we include in a proper way without tokenizing people of color in our arts communities? And then finally, in the lobby area, Summer will be taking you on a deep dive into the boycott, divestment, sanctions, the BDS movement that she talked about earlier, and what it looks like for anti-Zionist communities locally and globally. Okay, so we're open to take.
Sure.
Absolutely, we'll have about 20 minutes, about 15 minutes, and people can, if you want to move your car now, the workshops will start roughly around 5:00. Do we have any questions from the audience? Sure.
Looking for youth.
So one of my favorite activists, who actually had 350 bullet holes in his apartment that guaranteed his death, Fred Hampton, would start his organizing speeches with red power to red people, yellow power to yellow people, white power to white people, brown power to brown people, black power to black people. And what's so lovely about that is that we're talking about collective power and shared power as opposed to a hierarchy of power. And so my question is, someone who grew up in Kansas City and has recently come back, how do your groups work together? What does that collaboration look like, and how active is it, and how can someone become a part of all of these movements in a way that edifies the work and brings the city together?
There we go. So thank you for that question. I've been in Kansas City only 8 years. So I'm half Midwestern, half Californian, so I'm relatively new to the city. But I will say, in my short time that I'm here, I have seen the solidarity amongst black and brown folk really pick up, particularly since 4 or 5 years ago. Because most of the conversations about race relations in this community are led by white folks, and particularly white women, that are getting the paychecks. And that's happened across the board. And I feel like because of a lot of grassroots organizing that's been happening, black and brown folks have been doing. So we've sat on panels before. We just met today. However, I've been working with Fatima, who's in the audience, who's probably gonna help out with the seminar that's gonna happen later on, for a couple years now. Because we kept coming in these spaces and seeing white folks dominating the conversations on race and racism. So we collaborate together. I'm actually working with a Jewish organization, Avodah Tomorrow, doing anti-oppression work. And then my first question when they reached out to me, I was like, y'all talking about Palestine? Because I'm not gonna do this work as a black person not being in solidarity with Palestinian folk. And we're having conversations about what solidarity means. And then when Struggle got started, we had a sister organization called Una Lucha that looked at solidarity of black and brown folk, and they worked specifically with Ayotzinapa, the disappeared students that in September of 2014. It wasn't me and black brown unity, and also talking about anti-blackness in Latinx communities, because there's a lot of Afro-Latinx folk, right? And so I feel like the work that we've done, like, we've been in many spaces together, and when we're not in spaces like this, we're often collaborating with each other, like showing up to actions for one another, sharing each other's meetings and information. If I meet other folks that meet, if they're in other communities that aren't black, I'm like, here's so many other organizations and people you should meet. It's not always about me, about a black person, about bringing in black people. How can I make sure that communities can help build with one another?
So I truly do believe, like I said before, that in order for us to be free, we all need to come together and just fight for each other and with each other. And although Al Hadaf is a fairly new organization, I don't even think it's been around for a year. It's very new. It, like I said, Palestine is a very intersectional movement. So I'm sure I'm gonna see a lot of you guys around more often, and I'm really excited about that.
One thing that's actually coming up, actually on Monday, we're doing a combined workshop, multiracial organized workshop on disrupting institutional racism. So that's one practical way, just in the next few days, that a few of us here are part of it, and some other folks that aren't here. So.
And I would just like to add to your question that in Kansas City, Diane mentioned how hyper-segregated the city is, but also when we're talking about race in Kansas City, it tends to be black or white, right? And so all of us that are not black or white kind of are left out of that conversation. So it has been imperative for black and brown activists to work together. We do that. We're doing that through talks about, discussing anti-blackness. We're doing that through immigration work, where, black activists are like, there are lots of black immigrants, right? So that's something I've been very pleased to see, is different groups led by different people of color are coming together. It is so important that we do build that power together, because divided, we do not stand a chance at all. Is there another question?
In asking a question about how we might take away the control of thought and maybe end the occupation of language or decolonialize the discourse. We should notice that this intersection today of race issues and peace issues is what got Dr. King in so much trouble, really, with his own organizing groups, folks who wanted to be, salutary to the white establishment, and then ultimately to the highest levels of illegitimate power in the government, who then assassinated him a year to the day after he made the merger of civil rights here at home to the rights of Vietnamese people abroad. One thing I would maybe ask us to consider is the way that I consider myself a Jewish American patriot of conscience. I'm open to a dialogue, a debate, a critique of me for that self-identifier. But in terms of thinking through different aspects of privilege, I think it is interesting that we don't ask black folks who are trying to work on behalf of the rights of other black folks to say, how do we do this without this being anti-white or anti-Aryan or anti-Anglo, but then we do ask Palestinian activists to say, how do we do this without being anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic, which itself is already a colonialized term because the Palestinian people are Semitic. So that question I want to ask as a Jewish American patriot of conscience, how I can utilize my Jewish privilege in taking on Zionist power networks. I don't think it's fair to, ask Palestinian people to go debate or dialogue with Zionists, but I do think I have an obligation as a Jewish man of conscience to go and do that and to take that space and use my shield as far as it'll get me.
Really appreciate your question. I guess I haven't thought about it because I'm always only ever focusing on like Palestinian emotionality, or like how mentally exhausting it is to have Palestinians try and educate people about Palestine, because you are educating people about the fact that your identity is being erased. So I guess when you have groups that are doing birthright trips, or birthright trips, for those of you who don't know, is that any Jew around the world has the right under Israeli law to go to Israel and like visit Israel for the like with the ultimate goal of having a larger population of Jews, because Palestinians are a demographic threat to Israel. So when you have things like that, when you have former IDF soldiers breaking the silence of what they did to Palestinians, just put yourself out there and talk about it. I honestly, all I can say is just put yourself out there and talk about it, because Palestinians are actively censored.